From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And yes, indeed, it is the Boomer and the Babe Show, National Edition. Good morning to everybody on the West Coast. It's 11 o'clock in the morning, and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the East Coast. I trust everybody had a nice lunch, and we're glad that you're listening to us today. This is Wednesday, October 10th, 2012, and we are broadcasting from our studios in Sun City, Arizona. We have to change that lead-in music, but we've changed our studio locations, and we're real pleased to be able to do that. And I'm Pete Peters. Deborah Brown is off working with clients on some of the book publishing projects that we have, so she's not going to be with us today. But we invite you to go to theboomerthebabe.com, see everything that we're involved in, including one of our new entries into the projects. It's called Camel Talk. And Camel Talk is a situation where you can get involved and support the efforts of putting these Camel Talk books and a Camel Talk radio program together for youngsters from 3 to about 8 years old. Enjoy the adventures of the Camel Sisters, and they'll teach the children lessons of good citizenship and some health and some working together and not arguing and taking instructions and learning to read and learning to learn. So that's all what that Camel Talk is about, so please check that out for us if you don't mind. And again, that's boomerandthebabe.com. Today we have a special guest. Today is World Mental Health Day, I think it is, World Mental Health Day, and our doctor friend today is Dr. Gerald Hurwitz, and Dr. Hurwitz is with that organization, and we're going to be talking about mental health, and particularly mental health as it involves the senior population. Dr. Hurwitz, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show.
Well, thanks, Pete. It's really great to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. As I said before we got started off air, we're going to ask you for your two-minute movie. So why don't you go ahead and take a little time and tell us everything you want everybody to know about Dr. Gerald Hurwitz.
Well, let's see. I grew up in around the Philadelphia area and started to have some interest, believe it or not, in psychiatry from about the age of 15, and held out that I might be interested in medical school and a psychiatric career from then up to the very end of my college career. And all along the way, I gave some thought to other possibilities, but going into psychiatry always kept up at number one spot, and it did so right through medical school. So left to go to college, came back to medical school in Philadelphia, Jefferson Medical College, and on from there into New York City, where I did my residency in psychiatry at NYU in Bellevue. And since graduating there, I've been a psychiatrist at Columbia, where I'm also on faculty. Starting back about 8-9 years ago, I joined a group of colleagues at M3 Information, a company that was formed just then with the goal of developing the screen, which is called What's My M3, and this is a mental health screen that's meant really for all adults 18 or older to fill out and complete either in private at home on their cell phones, but also especially in their primary care doctor's offices. And the screen helps to identify the risk for four major mental health problems, and that's what brings me here today with you.
Well, I want to go back to this your attraction to psychiatry. What mm-hmm. was it about psychiatry that held your attention and drew you in?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've thought about this because I can't say I know 100% what were all the factors that motivated me in that direction. But I like science a lot, and I liked abstract thoughts, complicated thoughts, and so I like philosophy and I like science, too, and I like people. And so it sort of ended up being a perfect combination for me because I got to listen to people's stories and help people out, which I like, but I also got to think some fairly deep thoughts about what motivates people, what's important in life, what have you. So for me, it satisfied that sort of combined, impulse, and it's proved itself to be a great career for me.
Fantastic. I'm I'm always interested in what is the definition of mental illness? How would you define mental illness?
Well, you know, there's not any one perfect or textbook way to define it, but I think probably the best way to start talking about it, and I think this applies especially to your listeners, is that, you know, we all of us have moods, and some of the moods that we have include what I guess everyone would call a negative mood, something like, let's say, sadness or feelings of guilt or worry, nervousness, and anger. I guess those are the major negative feelings we all can have. And it's not for nothing that our brains and our minds work in such a way that we have these negative feelings, because they really can do some good in certain contexts. You know, if we're sad or feeling lonely, we try to seek out social companionship. If we're feeling guilty, hopefully it'll motivate us to, you know, do something about whatever we've done wrong. If we're feeling angry, perhaps we'll address some social injustice, what have you. But sometimes these negative feelings especially get a little bit out of hand, and they do not function in the way I just sort of quickly outlined, where they don't really play a role in fixing something or correcting something, or let's say they're just not constructive anymore. And in some instances, those feelings can become so persistent, intense, and constant that the person really ends up not functions less well than they would otherwise. And now they're moving away from the very thing that they want to do, which is to fix things or improve their lot or the lots of others or loved ones or other people around them. So it's really when those negative feelings get out of hand and are no longer sort of corrective, where we might find this is an illness. And if I may, just a wonderful analogy to this would be what in medicine we call the inflammatory response. You know, when we injure ourselves mildly or otherwise, but take, for example, a mild injury like a paper cut, the area there becomes red and a little swollen and painful, and actually it also gets a little warm. It heats up a little bit, and those are the cardinal signs of inflammation. Inflammation is normal healing. However, in some instances, inflammation, like, for example, in rheumatoid arthritis and lots of other conditions, but famously with rheumatoid arthritis, the inflammatory response just goes on and doesn't know when to turn itself off, and that's when treatment's necessary. And it's similar with those negative feelings I just described.
The mental illness comes in any number of, I would guess, degrees, variations, and maybe even diagnoses.
Correct.
Things like bipolar disorder, depression, and yeah, I'm sure you can mention some of the others. But what is, for instance, bipolar disorder? How is that manifest?
Well, the best way to start to answer that is to just talk about plain depression, which I think most people have a little bit more of a grip on. I think usually not a perfect grip on it is an illness, but most of us know what it means to be sad. And in what's referred to as ordinary depression, or technically unipolar, one-pole depression, is when people enter into phases of being quite hampered by low mood, depression, guilt, guilty ruminations, and then typically also have changes in their sleep and appetite and concentration. In bipolar disorder, what we find is that the people suffering from bipolar have both this tendency to have lows, as in a depression, that can be identical to the sort of lows, can be identical to the sort of lows that plain old depressive patients have. But they also have a different and a sort of an up phase to their illness. And that's the other pole. And that's why it's called bipolar. And the up phase, unfortunately, most people think of that right away as being a state of euphoria or elation, acting giddily and silly and irresponsibly, overspending, oversexed, not sleeping very much, having lots of energy. Those are a lot of the symptoms and signs of bipolar, the up period, which is, by the way, called mania, or milder forms are called hypomania. Somewhat counterintuitively, a person can have an up phase where their mood is not primarily elated or euphoric. It actually can be primarily irritable. And this is where it's easier to escape it. That condition can more easily escape detection. Because, you know, if someone's acting very giddy and laughing constantly and making jokes and can't seem to calm down, most even non-psychiatrists and non-medical people can identify them as being manic. But it's when they're mostly irritable and not in a laughing mood, let's say, or irritable and even depressed. Indeed, people can have up periods where their primary mood is sad or a mixture of sadness and anger. And it's in those cases of bipolar disorder where it's more subtle and more difficult to find a diagnosis quickly. That's important because misidentifying patients with bipolar disorder and incorrectly diagnosing them as having regular or unipolar disorder can lead to the wrong treatment. And then they can often get much worse as a consequence.
On the piece that I was sent prior to your, when we knew that you were going to be visiting with us today, it said they were talking about elders, but it said that they have to care for depression, anxiety, psychosomatic disorders, adjustment to aging, and schizophrenia. What is a psychosomatic disorder?
A psychosomatic disorder is a range of behaviors, but that would mean, let's say, an illness presenting to the doctor mostly as a number of physical complaints, you know, I guess most typically lower back pain, other sorts of aches and pains, headache, but also things like insomnia, low energy, what have you. And in some cases, the mood component to that condition, the mood or anxiety component, and that often exists in those patients with somatic disorders, that often is not the main complaint the patient lodges with their doctor. What they will do is that they'll show up at the doctor's office and complain most vocally about their physical symptoms. And in some instances, or many instances, doctors will end up spending a lot of time and a lot of money looking into these physical symptoms. And oftentimes after too long a period, they determine that a lot of this relates to the person's mood and their anxiety and not, in fact, any serious underlying medical condition. I think most individuals really, truly underestimate how badly physically they could feel due to a mental illness. It could be really quite profound. Feelings of fatigue, low concentration, no energy, poor sleep, tremor, headache, there's a whole range of physical symptoms that often sort of masquerade as physical illness when they in fact are due to the sort of somatic illness that you refer to here.
And the last one they mentioned in this list is schizophrenia. What is schizophrenia?
Schizophrenia is a condition that affects about 1% of the population worldwide, actually. And it's a condition that typically involves hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, that is, you know, voices, and delusions, which are very firmly fixed false beliefs about things. I mean, most classically that would be some form of paranoia where people think that they're being spied on or being followed or tracked. And this is quite a terrible and disabling condition because, you know, typically with those sorts of symptoms, the person does, you know, as we often say, lose touch with reality. And there are treatments for that that help to mitigate some of those symptoms and reduce them. But unfortunately, there's no silver bullet yet that really totally repairs these people and get them back to normal.
Many times, I mean, I've heard this said, somebody is depressed or they're anxious or they're just not functioning well, and there will be somebody of authority that will say, come on, just snap out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That without realizing that there may be other issues that you can't,
yes.
You can't just snap out of it.
That's right.
So what when somebody sees or suspects that some that an individual, loved one or close friend or whatever, is having issues, what is it that they can do to help them find their way out?
Well, you know, in a funny way, maybe the first thing they could do is to say, snap out of it. I'll tell you why. I typically defend family members, or anyway, the rendering of family members that are depicted in the way you say. I defend it in the following way. This is what I mean. We have a kind of a folk psychology that we all kind of grow up in our culture or even our subculture. And that includes things like encouraging people, coaxing people, reprimanding people, all sorts of, you know, interpersonal interactions between parents and children and teachers or coaches and students and players, et cetera, friends, coworkers. And a lot of those things often do work, you know, encouraging someone, exhorting someone, reprimanding someone. You know, these are, you know, normally thought of as being slightly negatively tinged, but they do work in many instances. I say that, you know, if you tried that and this is now someone, a loved one or a family member of a potentially mentally ill person, it's okay to try that. But, you know, there really should come a time when you size up this intervention saying, you know, I've been trying to exhort so-and-so, mom, dad, my son, my daughter, I've been trying to exhort them to do this. And no matter what I do, it doesn't work. It doesn't motivate them. And I think at that point, the light should go on and you should start to think, well, why are they struggling so much? And why, despite all my efforts to encourage them, maybe one or two or hopefully two or three different clever ways that they might try to encourage them, when that seems to fail, I think then that's one good reason to sort of step out and say, maybe we need to have an evaluation and look into whether there's a mental health issue here.
Mm-hmm. It's the case, as I understand it, that many times when a person's not feeling well for whatever reason, they're going to go to their family practice physician, and the family practice physician may not recognize the aspects of it being mentally a mental problem as mm-hmm. as the reason for the physical illness, and they'll test and they'll this and they'll that and they won't come up with anything. And why is it the case that this physician who you may have been relying on for years can't see the forest from the trees, so to speak?
Well, in some cases, because, again, the patient comes and is very vocal about the physical symptoms, as we were describing with somatic illnesses. Other times it's because it's a lot for, let's say, a primary care doctor to take on if they find a patient has a lot of, you know, mood symptoms. Even in their office, you know, there's a lot of sort of economic pressures on doctors to keep their office visits short and what have you. And so it becomes a bit overwhelming for some of the doctors to take these issues on. I'm afraid also in some instances, rather than spending the time that might be necessary to get to the bottom of what's ailing that patient, let's say in the mental realm, if they don't ignore it, and sometimes they do ignore it, sadly, about 50% of the times, by the way, these cases are overlooked by doctors. And another, among the patients who are properly identified as having a mental problem, in that 50%, about half of them get the wrong treatment. And so only about a quarter of people, in other words, get an appropriate treatment for mental illness when they pass through their primary care office. In some instances, they may just do something like write a prescription for an antidepressant without really getting to the bottom of what the person's problem may be. As I mentioned to you earlier, if you give a person with bipolar disorder an antidepressant, there's a very good chance you're going to make that person sicker.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important then to have a really useful, flexible, and broadly tuned mental health screen like What's My M3, which can actually assess the risk of depression, simple depression, versus bipolar disorder, then also anxiety disorders as well. And then finally, one other nice thing about the What's My M3 is that it it asks the patients about substance and alcohol use as well, and whether they might be using alcohol or other recreational substances or prescribed drugs as a way to manage their mental health symptoms. So overall, what we're hoping is that with What's My M3, the doctor who is short on time will be able to, first of all, pick out real cases of mental health problems, but also put the patient on the map in terms of where their diagnosis is likely to lie, and then they can commence the appropriate treatment.
How does a doctor know, or is, and we're going to get a little bit more detail because I got a lot of questions about this What's My M3 thing, but how does a doctor know whether or not the patient is giving them the straight scoop, so to speak, and they're not covering something up?
You know, the real straight answer to that is they never really can know. It turns out, you know, there are a number of people, quite a large number of people are afraid of illness to the degree, I mean, most of us are afraid of illness, of course, but there are quite a number of people who are afraid of illness to the degree where they actually want to bury their heads in the sand, or their head in the sand. This may be something, and I've not done a formal study on this, or nor do I know the research on it, but this may be, of course, something a little more prevalent among the elderly, where they're afraid of their mortality and they kind of don't want to think about getting sicker. So instead of, you know, being forthcoming about physical or mental symptoms, they might try to downplay them or ignore them, or as I said, bury their head in the sand. On the other hand, when those patients feel they have a doctor who knows how to manage these symptoms, or when they get other sorts of educational material that encourages them to be more forthcoming, we find that in many cases, and I would be silly to say all cases, but in many cases, individuals start to engage with the system in a more constructive way. And I think the idea, for example, of filling out a questionnaire that's sort of not directly with a doctor sitting there, but something that can be done in the doctor's waiting room, or even at home in the privacy of your home, people are a little more likely to answer these questions honestly. And again, there's no guarantee, but that seems to be the overall trend that we've found at What's My M3.
Right. What do you suggest when somebody has an elderly family member that they're caring for? And you hear things, as it was with my father, who's now deceased, died of quite natural causes, but he had Alzheimer's, dementia, all those functions. He died of a physical thing more so than a mental problem, but because he had some wounds that wouldn't heal,
right,
that he had inflicted while getting out of a wheelchair, of all things. But nonetheless, there came a time when he was lucid enough to know that he was not well. Mm-hmm. And he was also been a man that has never had owned a firearm in his life. And he said to me, go buy me a gun, clearly indicating what his intent would have been. And I said, no, Dad, we're not going to do it that way. It's just not going to happen that way. And it was over. But what do you do in a situation like that?
It's really, Liz, that's a very complex, it's a morally complex situation. And, you know, you don't want to ignore the person's complaint or deny the seriousness of what they're confronting. But at the same time, I think I would do exactly what you did. It comes down the side of trying to encourage him to, like, let's see what we can do to make your life and quality of life as high as possible. And, you know, it's interesting because, unfortunately, because of the scourge of Alzheimer's that so many elderly people are aware of, many of them, first of all, when they do not have Alzheimer's, many of them, because of other, let's say, slips in their memory or concentration or what have you, many of them sort of chalk it up to having something like Alzheimer's when, in fact, they don't have it. And I know I mentioned a few moments ago that most of us underestimate how markedly impaired one could feel from having a mental health condition. Here's a good example of it where people often don't appreciate that their concentration, their ability to remember things, to retain things, can really be markedly impaired by just by having a mood or anxiety disorder. And it gets complicated further because mood and anxiety disorders often entail some sleep disturbance. And having a sleep disturbance makes memory much worse. So that means that elderly people really owe it to themselves to move forward and get assessed for the sorts of conditions that, including the mental health conditions and other physical problems, that are reversible and treatable, because they may learn, and oftentimes they do learn this, that if they are more proactive about these symptoms and problems, that many of them can be addressed and corrected. Now, here's another important thing. The same is actually true even of patients with Alzheimer's, because what we know is that Alzheimer's patients are very sensitive are very prone to having, along with their memory and functional disability, lots of mood and agitation problems that are rolled into it. And so it behooves us to make sure that these patients are well taken care of, but also that their sleep and their mood and their anxiety or agitation are managed in a way so that they can maintain functioning at the highest possible level, at the optimal level, as long as possible, because we can really improve their quality of life, rather than to say, oh, well, you know, now you got it, it's all over with. There is often a lot of room to make these patients feel better and to improve their quality of life.
What happens when, what suggestions would you have when the elderly person says, well, first of all, everything you've mentioned, it's sort of like, well, that's one of them, that's one of them, that's one of them, that's one of them. And then the elderly person says, I don't want to seek treatment. I don't want to go to a doctor. There's nothing they can do about it anyhow. That's
right.
Just the way it is. And then proceeds to do nothing. And
yeah.
How would you suggest, I suppose that they could go to your MyM3,
mm-hmm.
and have them go through that process possibly. But beyond that, I mean, if they're not willing to go seek a physician because they just don't think that a physician knows what to do with old people, what kind of recommendations can you give?
You know, there's no silver bullet for that. It's a difficult problem, no doubt
yep.
about it. It's interesting when you ask about, like, you know, using something like What's My M3 to help them. One of the reasons, you know, that there's earlier screens that have been used that were not quite, we don't think, quite as broadly tuned to multiple diagnoses and what have you. One of the things that we found is that most doctors were not using these older screens that have been around for quite a couple of decades. They didn't really use them so much from the doctor's perspective to figure out whether the person was depressed. It turns out they often already concluded themselves the person was depressed because, anyway, well, I won't go into that, but the important point I'm driving at is that in many cases, these doctors would use the screen just to demonstrate to the patient by an objective measure that it isn't just me, your doctor, saying this, it's also this screen. And that, you know, that carries the day for some patients. I mean, that, so your notion was, I think, a reasonable one. Maybe just by demonstrating that you score in a range that suggests you're really at high risk for such a condition, that may persuade some elderly people to go forward. But it doesn't always. I'd love to think it does always works, but it doesn't. But it's a useful approach in some cases. In other cases, just to answer your question more broadly, you know, occasionally family members might call the primary care doctor or any doctor the patient may engage themselves with that they have a particularly positive relationship with. Family member may call the doctor, let's say, in advance or alert them to the fact that you're really worried about their mental health and say, could you ask the doctor to put in a pitch, you know, to sort of make it a doctor's orders kind of thing, and sometimes that will work. Occasionally, a member of the clergy could help, or a particular family member who has a lot of influence with a person who may be suffering. So pretty much you pull on whatever string might help, whatever lever might motivate the patient. You do your best, but there are all these options that are open to us.
Absolutely. And I think you just have to make sure that you have you understand what's in your bag of tricks.
That's right.
And
that's
what
right.
And what you can do. Let's talk a little bit more about the What's My M3 process and how it works. I've got it up here on my computer right now in front of me, and I'm seeing, for instance, the very first panel that I'm looking at says to start the screen now and ask for your history, your helpful link about the What's My M3. And to the right of that, it says there's a question. I don't know if this is the first one in the series because I have not, as I said, not taken it. Over the past 2 weeks or more, have you noticed the following? I feel sad, down in the dumps, or unhappy, and the questions and the obvious selections are not at all. Rarely, sometimes, often, and most of the time. Is mm-hmm. that pretty much what it's going to be like throughout the, 29 questions, is it?
Yeah. It depends on the format, but it's 27, 29, because in a couple instances, two of the questions are combined. But, yeah, officially we should say 29. The 29 questions are all of that sort. The total questionnaire is typically completed in under 3 minutes. And I do really mean that. It's not something that – there aren't many people who take more than 3 minutes. That's unusual. And the questions are very simple and straightforward. And so we have quite a number of questions devoted specifically to depressed mood, others to anxiety. We have a subset specifically for PTSD, which we knew was important to include also because of all the issues with our veterans, and another subset of questions about bipolar disorder. Finally, at the very end, there's four questions that we added just to make sure that the answers that we elicited in the first group that I just described, that they actually meant there was some real loss of function or disability. And so these questions relate to things like, are these symptoms affecting your work or home life, social life, school life, et cetera? And finally, have any of these symptoms led to you using alcohol or to using drugs to manage them? And those last four questions are sort of like functional impairment questions that mm-hmm. help also to measure how serious or not serious those symptoms may be.
I just opened this up and I see that they're all on the same one same page. And it mm-hmm. looks like it's obviously very easy to use. It says accept and view my assessment at the bottom. I want to get into what's done with these answers and these responses and what is the course of action beyond the taking of this self analysis type situation. And mm-hmm. but let's do that after I have a few commercials that I want to get out of the way here, and let's do that and we'll be right back to finish our conversation.
Great.
Boomer the Babe are the publishers of Boomer Series books. Our authors have their own shows on the Boomer and the Babe Network. We encourage you to listen. Ron Naraki, author of the forthcoming book, The 10 Commandments of Investing, is the host of Wealth DNA, a financial show about real estate investment. Learn how to build and manage your portfolio. Ron hosts the show, and he always has good information to pass along, as do his guests. Listen to Wealth DNA on the second and fourth Monday of the month at 8 a.m. Arizona time. Tom Liggering's another Boomer Series author. His book, Success or Failure, The Choice is Yours, is the basis of the show he does with his broadcast partner, Dr. Terry Munther. Listen to Success or Failure with Tom and Terry on the fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 a.m. Arizona time. Learn how you can maximize your performance in business and in life. The methods you employ can either help or hinder. The choice is yours. The Boomer and the Babe are proud to be affiliated with Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. Valley View is now serving Phoenix from their new 36,000-square-foot location at West Peoria and 107th Avenue in Sun City, Arizona. The new location houses the Food Bank, Feeding Arizona, and the Valley View Thrift Store. Feeding Arizona delivers food to other food banks and food pantries that are in need.
If you're looking for a 501c3 to support, go to valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. All donations are welcome, be it food, money, or volunteer hours. No donation is too small. Get a hold of Jesse Ramirez, founder and director, and say, I want to help. Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free.
And we're back. This is Wednesday, October 10th, 2012. We're talking about World Mental Health Day and what's my M3 process for determining your mental health condition. And we're talking with Dr. Gerald Horowitz with regard to all of these topics concerning mental health. Doctor, before we went to those breaks, I was asking you about the process of the What's My Three, assessment. I guess is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? And what is done with the information once it's been gathered?
Well, the easy answer is no, nothing at all. It's totally private. So the questionnaire that you were just viewing and completing, once the assessment's generated, that's really for your eyes only, and it's not shared with anyone. The patient then, or the user, then has the option to print up the assessment or email it or fax it or whatever, what have you, to their doctor or other clinician. And they also have the option to add the results to a Health Vault account. Health Vault's a Microsoft record, you know, electronic health record software where they'll hold it for you privately. But again, that's just something that's totally optional. The patient can just view the results once and close it and click on it, and that's the end of it. But we encourage people, of course, especially when results are positive or show that there is some risk, to share it with their doctor.
So when the information is compiled and you want to view your assessment, what does the assessment show? I mean, does it say, oh, you're fine, you don't have any problems, or maybe you should really consider seeking treatment, and maybe variations in between? How does that all work?
The easiest way to sort of render that is to sort of compare it to what most of us nowadays know about, which is a cholesterol level. Most of us know that we'd like to have our cholesterol be 200 or lower, and not because having a cholesterol of 200 or higher means we have heart disease, but it means we're at risk for heart disease. So with What's My M3, there's a cutoff number of 33, as it turns out, and that's highlighted on the assessment report, so no one has to commit that to memory. But the number 33 is able to sort of find about 85% of people with documented mental health problems. And for those below 33, again, about 85% seem to have no diagnosis when they were studied in a – we did a study at the University of North Carolina. Well, we didn't, but the University of North Carolina did do a study of the M3 in 2010, and that's what they found. So that means that this overall threshold of 33 is able to really find many – to sort of separate the true cases from the non-cases – quite effectively, and it doesn't give you a particular diagnosis, but it does say this is cause for a closer look by a trained professional. But the result also, the assessment page does then break down your responses for each of the four subcategories I mentioned, so depression, anxiety, PTSD, and bipolar disorder, and it again gives you an individual risk for each of those four subcategories. And further, finally, it does just that the report just gives you a lot of very useful, it's brief, but it gives you a lot of useful education about these illnesses and what steps you might take to manage them. Finally, in the case where a person does not score 33 or has quite a low score, they're said, okay, it looks like you have no problem right now. But because we do realize, as you mentioned earlier, some people tend to, you know, deny a little bit or underplay their symptoms, we touch on that briefly and say, look, just in case you may yet feel you might have some problems you want to talk to your doctor about, even though the score was low, but, you know, and in that case, go ahead and do it. But the score you achieved seems to suggest that you're doing okay.
Are you finding, because I see that a lot of this information that I have here in front of me is as it relates to seniors, is this a larger concern to seniors now than it ever used to be? It's because there's more seniors, or are seniors just much more susceptible to mental illness?
Oh, the answer is really both. I mean, there are more seniors, and so and I think there are more seniors who've come of age during a time when mental health problems have finally begun to get some attention. And secondly, it's been an ongoing sort of quiet epidemic among seniors for many generations now. The risk of depression and suicide is really quite high. And just as I mentioned, you know, our expectations for patients with Alzheimer's can be quite low. I think our expectations for life in the senior years could be much too low for many people, and they have very low expectations. And so when trouble occurs, they often say, well, this is what I expect, and I'm not going to expect more for myself. And that's not a good attitude, because it's wrong. I mean, and people, when they make the effort to address these mood and anxiety symptoms, they often do really quite well with treatment. So, yeah, it's a particularly important thing among the seniors who have such a high rate of mood and anxiety symptoms.
Well, it's interesting that the boomer generation, and I'm not looking at the boomer generation as being a, as being mm-hmm. seniors, but the boomer generation and what we're finding in doing our show and other things that we're involved in certainly has this active retirement mentality. We're still going to keep working until we can't work anymore, basically, mm-hmm. maybe because we have to, frankly, but also because we don't want our retirement to be like our father's retirement was, or our possibly grandfather's retirement was, if he did retire at all. I mean, when my dad retired, he retired to this nice house in Sun City and played golf three times a week and did a few things around the house, and they did a little traveling and so on and so forth. But he wasn't in beyond that, and I'm not saying that that wasn't engagement, but he wasn't engaged in anything particularly mentally taxing other than building in addition to the house. But that's something that was almost as if that was part of his life, because he'd built a house before. So I guess where I'm going with this is there is a definite difference between the boomer generation, the leading edge boomers, of which I'm one, and our senior parents, who are now 89, 90, 95, whatever they may be, in that we have a different outlook on what we can do at an advanced age than maybe they ever thought of. And maybe that is something that leads to some depression and feeling of uselessness.
No, I think that is it's a complex thing. I mean, it is absolutely the case that I think it really goes back to this question about what our expectation is and adjusting our expectation. You know, it is, as you know, most of us, and for really some time, the idea has been that, all right, well, look, if we're in retirement, we want to kind of relax, enjoy ourselves, you know, keep stimulated, because there's no doubt that's an important thing to do. But, you know, nipping at the heels of that attitude is this anxiety. I'm going to get old and frail, and I'm not going to be able to remember things and whatnot. So there's a real tension between these two, the fear on the one hand, and then that drive to keep ourselves up and stimulated. I think that, and enjoying and having pleasure and enjoying those years of our lives, the most important thing is to think that, you know, there really is a little bit of a science to this, that there, you know, it's not perfect. It's not a guarantee. People do, unfortunately, still to this day and age, develop Alzheimer's. And we're not yet at the stage where we can, you know, really treat it really effectively or prevent it at all. But there is a logic to this idea of keeping yourself stimulated and in the game, so to speak. when these mental health symptoms, and this is the part that a lot of people don't get an easy intuitive grasp of, when these symptoms start to encroach on our ability to keep going and have fun and be stimulated, then you got to get that treated. That's a really important thing. And again, it's because it can be treated in many cases so that a person can, you know, be active mentally and physically, that's why we owe ourselves to make sure it is done.
Yeah, and then I think there's also issues that come into play, and I'll use my 89-year-old mother as an example of this. She cared for my father for 10 years of his dementia, Alzheimer's, the tail end of which the last several years we were here to help her with that as best we could. But nonetheless, she was the primary caregiver. Finally, he passed. As it in many cases is, it's almost somewhat of a relief. Not that you want to see somebody go, but it's nonetheless, there is a deep breath that's taken at that time, I think. And then 3 months after that, she had a stroke. Mm-hmm. And now she feels, and rightfully so, that she has been dealt a really bad hand here. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a lot of the issue, because all of a sudden it was snatched from her. She was ready to say, okay, I'm moving on with my life. I'm going to do some of the things I haven't been able to do for the last 10 years, certainly the last 5 years, taking care of Dad. I don't regret doing that, and so on and so forth. And I'm going to go out and I'm going to start going back to my ceramics classes or whatever it was she was going to do. And she had a stroke, and all of a sudden, nope, can't drive anymore. You're done. Mm-hmm. You know, you're done. You're flat done. And then, of course, doesn't want to go anywhere. Then doesn't want to get into the vans and the shuttles that can take her there. Doesn't want us to take her anywhere. She just doesn't want to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like classic depression to me.
That's right. Yeah, oh, that's right. And we do know that patients after stroke have a particular tendency to fall into depressions. And, you know, many people would say, well, of course, you know, who wouldn't? It's a depressing thing to have happened to one. No, it turns out that as compared to other conditions that are sort of, let's say, more or less equally disabling, patients with stroke have a slightly higher level of depression, you know, compared to these other conditions. And many of us think that's because of the effect that the stroke actually has on the brain functioning. But there's no denying that some of what she was expecting and thinking about her future is no longer, is cut off or constrained now because of the limitations the stroke has brought. You know, what most of us want to hope that we can do in a situation like that is sort of rise to the occasion and, you know, adjust our plans a little bit and make some changes and then go on and pursue some other interests, maybe, you know, depending on, of course, on what kind of illness is struck. If it's a stroke, it may mean that we have to adjust physically to some differences in what we might do. But you know, there's so much that can be done with a clear head and a good spirit, and, you know, feeling well, that most people, and I dare say this would apply to your mother as well, most people can come up with really good alternatives that they can enjoy. Once that sort of depression sets in, their imagination, their ability to creatively come up with alternative solutions is just gone.
Yes.
And it's gone. So you have to be able to sort of rekindle that. And first of all, I often say to my patients, look, I know this. I know you there's a true failure of imagination. Literally, you can't imagine any alternatives or any other options. And the fact is that failure of imagination, I believe, or I contend, is due to your mood state and to a treatable mood state in many cases. Mm-hmm. So let's go forward and let's get it treated and let's see what we can come up with. And so that's the recommendation. And many patients now, a lot of neurologists know this, that many patients after going through a stroke or put on antidepressants almost as a matter of course, because they know the rate of depression is so high.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of these notes that I have here indicate that undiagnosed mental illness can shorten the lifespan. How does that all happen?
Yeah, it's a tough question. Well, you know, there's not any one way, let's say, that we say it, because it doesn't really, apparently it does not get in there and where your brain and say, okay, let's change the setting for this person's lifespan. But, you know, essentially what happens is that a whole, most of us, you know, who are lucky enough to avoid, you know, accident or injury that does us in, or suicide, of course, most people who die of what are referred to usually as natural causes die of some form of a chronic illness that just progressed, and then the complications of a chronic illness. So in that case, I mean hypertension, high blood pressure, that is, diabetes, arthritis, you know, other sorts of chronic illnesses, COPD, you know, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. These things kind of wear us down slowly. And it turns out that a whole range of studies has found, and it's really quite impressive, that in almost every case, and I think, as far as I know, in every case with the conditions I've mentioned, having a depression or anxiety disorder along with them just intensifies the severity of those symptoms. And that could be either because the patients are unable to sort of keep up with treatment as diligently. It could, in some cases, affect stress hormones in the body that have a negative impact on the course of the illness. This may happen in high blood pressure, and it may happen in diabetes, and it may happen in COPD. So that in each of these individual illnesses, there's a multiplying effect of the mood or anxiety disorder. And so it progresses those illnesses, and they snatch our lives away at an earlier point.
There's an indication here that the mental health illness costs the country $70 billion a year.
That's right.
And how can this 3-minute mental screening help to alleviate some of those costs, number one? And number two, maybe this will end up being the last question that we get into. Tell us how that can help alleviate those costs. But then again, aren't the mental illness benefits in many insurance policies, they have a limit, and it's not that great a limit. You get so many visits, and that's the end of it. Is that still the case?
And there's a lot of sort of political action in this area of trying to bring forward as what they call, you know, parity for mental illness. And it's the letter of the law, but in many cases there have been sort of loopholes in this law. So some of the insurance providers have found ways of sort of minimizing the reimbursement for mental health care. We're all hopeful that that's going to continue. That's going to continue to improve to the point where it's a true case of parity with physical illness. But as to your first question about how it might help with the cost, mental illnesses are really quite prevalent. And even when they're mild, as I was just describing, they can have a multiplier effect on other illnesses. And in many cases, that $70 billion you refer to relates to this multiplier effect, making physical illnesses worse, or the course of physical illnesses worse. So by improving that care and treatment, we're going to be improving the outcome in the treatment of physical illness. So that's important. Secondly, when we identify these mental symptoms, the mood and anxiety symptoms at an earlier point, it makes these conditions easier to treat from the standpoint of psychiatrists and primary care doctors. So by nipping them in the bud at an earlier point, I think we also prevent a lot of illness and a lot of treatment. And so basically by improving the efficiency in the system, one last point would be in avoiding misdiagnosis and mistreatment. As I mentioned, the What's My M3 is the first screen that both searches for depression and bipolar and anxiety all rolled into one screen. And so it helps to avoid misdiagnosis. And we know that when bipolar patients are misdiagnosed, it is it's hell for the patients because of the physical symptoms, I mean, because of the suffering it entails, but it also means a much longer and harder and more costly course in terms of their medical treatment.
One last thing I did want to make sure that we touch base with today, and that is the stigma of mental health. We all have heard the stories and seen the old newsreel films of people being shunted away into a mental health facility where they're just laying in a bed, maybe even restrained. It has created over the years just one hellacious stigma of somebody that has mental illness and the fact that there's just no salvation for them. What can we do, or what can be done, to help eliminate some of that stigma?
Well, I think, you know, the best sort of way to address that stigma is just through success. You know, successful treatment helps a lot. I know a lot more people now do engage in mental health care than they did a generation ago. There are some people think that's been overdone, and I think that's a little bit wrongheaded. I think there are cases where people are not properly diagnosed, or they're put on, sure, they may be put on medications too quickly. But improving the ability of doctors to sort of identify these cases correctly and manage them correctly, that, for one, is going to improve success in the treatment. And I think, again, success is going to help with that stigma. Because when people feel that they really have a real choice to get over these things, it's going to be a little less shameful to them. Other than that, I think that just sort of spreading the word and getting more people comfortable with the idea that they need to be aware that these are real symptoms. And just like with the earlier idea about cholesterol, there was a time when people barely knew what cholesterol was, and now most people have a real working knowledge of it and how important it is to keep a track of. And so I think that through regular mental health screening, as would be provided by What's My M3, we're all going to be a little bit more comfortable with just assessing these symptoms, and that is probably one of the best ways to overcome stigma.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. When people find out that these people don't have to be shunted away, they can be helped. They can also find remedy and be allowed to live normal lives without having to be, I guess, diminished in any way by others. It all starts to get positive. It wasn't that long ago that almost any disease, illness, physical illness, in many cases, people were thought of as less than human because they had maybe a malady, a malformation, or something like that.
Exactly. Right.
And it all comes with hopefully time and knowledge and education. So. I think it's still a ways to go, but I think we're getting closer.
That's right.
I think this MyM3 process can certainly help. We're down here to the short rows, Doctor. Why don't you go ahead and give us what I like to call your shameless self-promotion about your process and how people can do it, and anything that you feel like people need to know about interacting with your organization or the process itself. So,
all right, well, great. Look, I mean, I'll just say this because I thought we got to say so much about it, and I think that's wonderful, and I thank you for that. What'smym3.com is the website address, and What'sMyM3 is also available as a phone app or an iPad or other tablet app, also at the Droid store. And it's called, again, What's My M3 is the name of the app. It's right now the number one mental health app in both of those stores. An important disclaimer is that M3 Information, our collaborative group that put this together, it's all privately funded. We have had no involvement with pharmaceutical companies or what have you. We don't, in particular, promote medication treatment over psychotherapy. We advocate for both forms of treatment where appropriate, and I encourage everyone to go take a look at it and see what they think, because they can use it themselves or any loved ones they have some worries about. It's a really nice site, and it gives a lot of nice education and background about all the stuff we spoke about today.
Well, that's great, and as I said, as I was looking here at the site itself, and actually at the assessment, it's a very easy to use assessment. So there really shouldn't be any trepidation with using it. So that makes it nice as well.
Yeah, it's private and anonymous, and it's as they say in the field here, it's HIPAA compliant, meaning that it does conform to the government's requirements for personal privacy for health records.
Very good, very good. Well, Doctor, thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate it. I've got a phone number here that's up on the board. I trust that's the one that I could call you at. I want to place a quick call to you as soon as we're completed here. There's a couple of things that I'd like to mention to you.
That would be great.
Off air. And thanks again for being my guest today. I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. It's been all good information. It's something that a lot more people need to know about it, and I hope we can get it out to them via this show.
Thanks, P. Me too. It was a really great opportunity. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining me. Take care.
Okay.
Have a great
day. Bye-bye. You too.
You've been listening to the Boom and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.